So I'd like us to begin with a short meditation. And as far as I can remember, I think I may have invented this meditation. So see how you get along with it. So the basic idea is we try and find, we wait, actually, for something like an itch to come. You know, like something that we want to kind of just touch the eye, or we just want to rub the cheek, or, you know, touch some part of the body. Now, sometimes we're just going to take 10 minutes. Sometimes that's not enough time for an itch to turn up. So if an itch doesn't come, then we can rely on, you know, like an irritation somewhere in the body that makes us want to move a little bit. And all we're going to do is, this meditation is just called Don't Scratch the Itch. Okay, so all you have to do is just wait for that opportunity to arise. So there's going to be an itch or an irritation or a calling to move. And then we just don't do it. And we see what happens when we don't do it. Okay, so does that make kind of sense? Not a very complicated meditation. But it's really, really helpful for the rest of the content of the talk that we do this together. So I wish you the best of good karma, that you get an itch and that you get to stay with it. Let's just see if we can find one. just staying on the lookout. If you've already found an itch or an irritation that makes you want to move, what feels stronger to you? The desire to scratch or move, or the aversion to the itch or sensation? Is there any difference? If you still haven't found anything uncomfortable or itchy for your attention, what's it like just to be looking around the body for something like this? How does that feel? And if you have found something and you're not itching or moving, scratching or moving, how close can you come to the sensations of this experience? How much space in consciousness can you give to this experience? What's the effect, the feeling of coming closer? What's the effect, the feeling of giving more space? So hopefully that was a useful way of doing some practice. And hopefully it will also be useful for an understanding of some of the content of this talk. But it's also a practice I like to do just some of the time anyway. So please make yourself comfortable for listening, whatever that would mean. Interesting to see how different comfortable for listening and comfortable for meditation postures can be. Hopefully they're quite similar, but they do call for slightly different aspects. It's a little bit different when there's someone outside talking to you than when you're kind of sitting with this internal speaker. Speaking away. Are people okay with the temperature at this point? You're getting a bit hot. Can we have this one on? Is that easy to do? It's not easy, but we can do it. So this evening I want to talk a little bit more about metta and emptiness, particularly from the perspective of what goes on in our heart minds, what goes on in our experience in meditation. And so metta, I think we're kind of getting familiar with a sense of that friendliness that we can bring to experience. And emptiness, this is kind of a working definition for us, is that quality that things are not just how they appear. If we think that things are not just how they appear. So I'm going to say some obvious stuff, and then hopefully I'm going to say some stuff that's maybe less obvious. So we are beings that think, yeah? And at any time, we can be in a world of thoughts. On this practice of meditation, we can really know what it's like at times to be breathing, and we know that we're breathing. We're sitting in the hall, and we know that we're sitting in the hall. And at other times, we can be sitting in the hall and breathing, but where we are is in a completely other world that's made up of, you know, thoughts and emotions and imagination and fantasies and the past, the present. So we're both really gifted by this creative mind, and it can also be part of the struggle of meditation. Yeah. Come back, mind. Hang out with the body. But it somehow it just can't quite do that. And you know, this is one of the core principles of the Dharma, and those who've had a flick through the Dhammapada, these short sayings of the Buddha, will know it begins with talking about the mind, talking about the heart mind, or talking about the heart, we could say. The heart mind is the forerunner of all things. It goes before everything. Some even say our life is the creation of our mind. Or at least our life is co-created with this mind. The mind is so significant in having this conscious experience that we're having right now. Yeah. Processing all of this information, the information of existence itself, the information of teachings. And it has such a significant impact on our experience. And we know that we can go through a day and have such a range of thoughts. You know, the really, really delightful thoughts, and everything seems to be going well. and the really more dark or distressing thoughts, and things really are not going well, really not feeling supported for us. And there's a saying that Jack Kornfield uses, which is, who is your enemy? Your mind is your enemy. Who is your friend? Your mind is your friend. Yeah, so, what does he say next? Learn the ways of the mind. Learn the ways of the mind. Tend the mind with care. Really, really useful information for us to keep bringing in. What's worth considering is that the Buddha offers us something very radical. And for some reason we haven't picked up on this in kind of Western culture of the senses. We talk about having five senses typically. The Buddha would insist that there's a sixth sense, and this sixth sense is the intellect, is the emotional quality of the mind. And so we absorb the world through seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, also through thinking. And we may think, this is like a very special type of sense, because basically we make the thoughts. It's my thoughts that I'm making. But that's kind of a way of thinking, and this might sound confusing, that have we really understood how these sense doors work? Are we imagining that there are sounds out there? Yeah. And that we're just hearing those sounds? I believe what's literally happening is that there's some kind of vibration in the air that then contacts here, and then we turn that into sounds. We turn that into words. We turn that then into meaning, which is kind of a type of thought. And so all of the sense doors both discover and create the world, but possibly none more than the mind. Yeah. Okay. I'm just testing you on the confusion levels. Mm-hmm. Can I confuse you easily or not so easily? No, I didn't shake you off yet. You're still with me. But what tends to happen, and perhaps that's partly because they appear to be coming from within us, these thoughts, yeah, is that we're much more likely to associate with the thoughts as a sense door than with any of the others. You know, it probably hasn't been that much today where you've thought, I am the sound of the air conditioning. I don't like myself for being the sound of the air conditioning. And yet certain thoughts will arise in our mind, and we might think, I am annoying to myself. You know, this thought is coming to me again. I am thinking this again. And yet the very reason that we can be annoyed with ourselves implies that we are not in control of our thoughts, any more than we're in control, perhaps, of the sound of what an air conditioner makes. And yet we associate with that. We get entangled in that. It becomes really problematic for us. So treating thoughts as a sense store is such a liberating teaching, such a liberating teaching. And I want to draw from what I think is a really excellent sutta in the Buddhist tradition, yeah, called Two Sorts of Thinking. And in it, the first thing that I want to draw out of it is that the Buddha refers to the thought process in just what I think is the most brilliant way of regarding thoughts. And he has this way of saying, the thought occurred to me. The thought occurred to me. Yeah, does that make sense? Can you translate that into Hebrew in a good way? Yeah. So rather than I am thinking, the thought occurred to me. Much like a sound occurs to me. Yeah. just that transformation towards our thoughts might be liberating enough. So when we find ourselves thinking, the thought is occurring to me that I can't meditate, whatever it is, a bit more lightness, a bit more space there. And that lightness and space is significant. So we're not in control of our thoughts. And also, none of our thoughts hang around very long. Yeah. And yet we can really associate with them, really identify with them, or take ownership of them. But which one? They're just not hanging around. And they're so, what's the word? Ephemeral is the word I was going to use, but that probably isn't a word so accessible to everyone. They're what are they made of? What are thoughts made of? You can't grasp one. You can't hold on to one, really. And yet they have such a massive impact on our life. Everything we think to do comes through this kind of realm of thoughts. Yeah? All the decisions we make, all this processing of existence coming through thoughts. Yeah, what are they? I don't know if that's really a useful question. What are they? I mean, but just holding that sense of the mystery as well as the impact. And so the Buddha would take these types of descriptions of a phenomena that is constantly changing. It's really transparent, ephemeral, ungraspable. Is that something you want to identify with? Is that something it feels helpful to identify with? And so, you know, he says, no, it's not. And there's this nice bit of another sutta, not from the same one. It's SN 1261, if you wanted to know it. But it says, it would be better for the uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person to hold to the body composed of the four great elements rather than the mind as the self. So it'd be better for us if we thought this body is who we are than this mind. And he said, but why is that? Why would he say that? And he says, because this body composed of the four great elements, so, you know, that's the cosmology they had at the time, you know, earth, air, fire, water. So this body is made of this, and it lasts for a year, 2 years, 3, 4, 5, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 years or more. It's a long life for a body, but I suppose it also decomposes and can stick around. So that's the lifespan of that. But what's called a mind, the intellect or consciousness, by day and by night arises as one thing and ceases as another, moment to moment, constantly changing. And if we're identified with something which is constantly changing, we're identified with something which is unreliable and stressful to be identified as something that's that unreliable because it changes so much. So therefore he says it would be better that you identify with your body and let the mind, you know, not be so identified with. He's a compassionate guy, I think. So I think it's how can we bring this in as a good practice? What could be a good practice for us? We're going to get identified with our thinking. Yeah? Maybe we can just take that as like a number one assumption. I'm going to be identified with my thinking at some point. Another really good assumption we can have is I am thinking. I'm probably thinking. If we happen to be wrong about that, it's okay, you know, we might miss a few. I wasn't actually thinking. But most of the time we're going to be thinking and we're probably going to be identified with that thinking. So that's already like step one in the practice. we won't be surprised and we won't be disappointed to find thinking and identified with the process of thinking. Now what can we do? So what's often problematic is we're too identified, we're too close to that thing because it's arisen within us to really get a grip on it. But we need to work with this. We need to relate well to our thinking. Yeah. So what's helpful is that the body's here to help us, right? Where is this felt in the body? Where is this thought having some resonance in the body? Now, it almost certainly is having some resonance somewhere in the body. And so that can be a really helpful way of getting to know our thoughts. If you go to thoughts as thoughts, they're slippery, they'll slip away, they'll disappear. The primary thing we're interested in, actually, is how is this thinking contracting the body, shrinking, squeezing, tightening the body? Looking for those kind of locations. What's that doing in the chest, in the belly, in the shoulders? Yeah, all of those areas. Because everything correlates. Body and mind are actually always in conversation with each other. Now, one of the ways that we can relate well then with the thinking is what happens if I open that contraction, if I release that tightness, yeah? If I give more space here, give more breath. So just as today we're working with pain in the body through all these techniques, yeah? Sending metta to parts of the body, opening out the space, breathing through, breathing out of. Are there others? Were there others? Maybe. So all of those, we can use those with thinking by relating to thinking in the body. Does that make sense? Still not confused you enough? Okay. So the core principle of all of these Dharma teachings is for the release of dukkha. Identification with thoughts is dukkha. Okay? So when there's identification with thoughts, it will be causing contraction, because contraction is dukkha. And the release of contraction?
Explain dukkha.
Explain dukkha and contraction.
Why not? Kibbutz.
Kibbutz. Nice. Kibbutz. So dukkha is this whole range of experiences that we can have, which we would say they are stressful, they are distressing, they are unpleasant, and the particular parts of the dukkha that we are interested in and that the Buddha is suggesting a path to be free from are these ways of relating to experience which cause those qualities of contraction, which cause those qualities of being distressed and stressed. Yeah. So that's what I'm going to be using as that definition for now. Now, in meditation, there are various kind of ideas that we could have of what to do with thoughts and with thinking. And it could be that we imagine that this freedom, this nirvana, this ending of dukkha, will come about with the ending of thoughts. And therefore, thoughts are the problem. Yeah. The thinking of thoughts is the problem. And so then that becomes tied up with the path of, you know, freedom is also freedom from all types of thinking. For me, that's kind of quite a complex idea. I'm not exactly sure what life then looks like, but that's fine for me if that's part of your model. And it could be that another model would be we just need to accept that we think and move on from that. You know, that could be another model. I'm not suggesting either model as a way, but just like kind of just naming that. What I think is most useful is actually how do we relate to the thinking that is occurring? How do we skillfully meet the thoughts, the emotions, the mind states, the moods, the views, everything that can occur in the mind. Because, to come back to what Jack Kornfield was saying, you know, the mind can be a friend, the mind can be an enemy. And I think it's quite helpful to imagine that this mind is going to be our ally on the path. Yeah, it's going to be our supporter, it's going to be our benefactor, if we use it well, if we use it skillfully. And the Buddha would say, none can do more good for you than your well-trained mind. As beautiful and wonderful as your friends and your family and everyone can be. Yeah, if you can get your mind well-trained, then you've got really something on your side. So let's dip into this two sorts of thinking sutta a little bit. So the Buddha was really, really skilled in taking us through very complex things like thinking with a really skillful precision and an appearance of simplicity. Yeah, it's just like, there's this. Is this or that? So basically, is your thinking causing dukkha or is it supporting release? No, it's just kind of very simple. There's just kind of two sorts of thinking in a sense. Or we could say there's metta in our thinking or there's non-metta. And the idea is when we see that it's non-metta, we abandon it. We stop doing it. When it's metta, we can allow it to continue. It's not a problem. Thoughts that are absolutely soaked in metta, they don't do a lot of harm. Yeah. They actually bring a lot of good. And in the Buddha's case, he actually describes in this sutta that before he developed this practice of dividing his thinking into two sorts, he was a bodhisattva, one on the path to awakening. And it seems, from the description of the sutta, that by dividing his thoughts into two sorts, he attains full liberation. Quite an amazing interpretation of the sutta, perhaps, but that's what he's describing. So the particulars of this dukkha or metta ways of thinking is thoughts that are focused around sensuality, about getting things I want, you know, the really kind of petty things in life, when we kind of go up for another plate of the food because the kitchen staff keep making it too delicious, and we say to them, you know, tone it down, guys, we don't want them getting too greedy, but, you know, what can they do, they're too talented. And then so we go up and we get another plate, even though we've had enough, just to kind of have that sensuality, that sense desire. And the other part is that once we've eaten too much and we start hating ourselves, is the second part, the ill will that we can feel towards beings, including ourselves. Yeah. Not good enough, I don't want you, rejection. Those kind of thoughts that we can have. And also, thoughts that have at their root actually some malice, some harmfulness, thoughts that actually want to kind of go out into the world and not do good. And they can occur to us at times, you know, when we're angry, when we're really wound up. So all of those types of thinking, if you examine them, what do they lead to? You know, what they tend to lead to is dukkha. And so the alternative would be, rather than sensuality, the Buddha's describing thoughts that have the flavor of renunciation, you know, letting go, finding that we're actually happy enough with that first plate of food, and we don't need that second one. You know, I'm already happy. Why would I eat? You know, you're not going to make myself more happy, so we renounce. Or it could be that feeling of generosity, you know, or gratitude. Those ways that we feel satisfied with this much is enough. And of course, the opposite of ill will, the opposite of rejection and hatred, is this metta, kindness. And the opposite of harmfulness is the compassion and care that we can feel for other beings and wishing them well. And then so for the Buddha, when a thought of gratifying oneself, this sensuality, this kind of selfish, petty desire would arise, he saw its shortcomings. And we can actually do the same, right? This isn't just practices for someone on the brink of becoming a Buddha. Is we look at this and see, that leads to my own affliction, my own harm, yeah? Or the harm of others. Or the harm of both of us. It gets in the way of clear seeing. It promotes agitation, tension, stress, and does not lead to unbinding, nirvana, the letting go, the release of dukkha. And you can do this towards anything, ill will, yeah? Harmfulness doesn't support us deeply. But then you can flip it around and see that renunciation, what does that lead to? What does that promote? What does that do for me and the other? So it's in tune with what we really wish. It just turns out it's quite difficult for us to go there.
What is renunciation?
Renunciation is, yeah, great, thanks.
Letting go of
things, yeah. And then, so we look into this and we actually see that the old thrill that we used to get from getting more, with that clear seeing, kind of hard to get the fire going. It's become damp wood, yeah. We've seen it doesn't lead to good. Doesn't lead to well-being, and it doesn't lead to freedom. So maybe it's not the right thing to do. And so the Buddha would say, it's subsided, it's sunk away. That thought, which seemed so real, had such presence, was taking control of this human existence. It subsided by bringing clear seeing towards it. And whenever thinking imbued with sensuality had arisen in me, I simply abandoned it, dispelled it, kind of vanished, wiped it out of existence. And wiping something out of existence actually sounds quite violent to us. But of course, we're talking about thoughts, yeah? Once we're not thinking that thought, it's wiped out of existence. That's just the nature of thinking. Yeah? It's not a violence against thoughts. And the same is true, you know, of ill will, of harmfulness, all of that. So it really becomes this question, like, what am I thinking? What am I thinking right now? And it's going to be on one side of this spectrum or the other, to some degree. And then can I, if it's on the dukkha side, can I see through it? Can I investigate it? Can I release it? And if it's more on the renunciation, the letting go side, can I support it? Can I allow it to be there? I really love this simplicity of this. It feels very accessible. It at least appears to be very accessible. And it turns out, yeah, it goes all the way. Can really support our practice. So thinking isn't a problem, but ways of relating to thinking can really bring release. And so it's important to know this isn't about passivity, right? It's not just that there's nothing beneficial from desires or aversions. And you know, I feel like it's helpful to kind of perhaps slightly muddy the waters of this brilliantly clear teaching with this point that we actually need intelligence. Yeah. We need that quality of discernment because we actually do also want to engage with life, shape our perspective, and see through things. and beyond them, you know, into more and more wisdom. And so this simplicity of this approach might cause us to kind of be rejecting and accepting a preconceived range of what thinking can be. What this is a really skillful way of meeting thoughts. So that we get to know them, get to know their flavor, get to investigate them. And what's interesting to know that in the end, the Buddha didn't even encourage us to have thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of metta, thoughts of compassion and care. Because he would say, even if I spent all day thinking that, and that no harm would come to this being or other beings, it would eventually get tiring. Yeah. And when I'm tired, then the whole meditation practice becomes much more difficult. Which is perhaps a good time to talk about tiredness. Yeah, because that's something that can happen to us in the meditation. Some people lying down. Can happen in Dharma talks as well. It can happen at any time. Tiredness could happen at any time. You have to be aware of it. So, actually, another way of talking about the two sorts of thinking is how they fit into this map that gets called the hindrances, things that get in the way of deep, nourishing experiences in meditation. So, the two sorts of thinking, in a way, are greed and hatred. Yeah. In the first part of the pairing, the first sort of thinking is greed and aversion. And we can see that in our thinking process. But that's not the only things that can hinder us. It's actually too much energy or too little energy can be a really clear aspect that can be a real hindrance to us. I don't know if anyone's experienced a lot of restlessness, where there's just too much energy in the system, and we just don't want to sit still. We want to get up, we want to go out, we want to go for a run, we want to do something else. All those times when we just can't get the enthusiasm going, the interest going, we're just dropping off to sleep, and everything we're trying, we're really just on the brink of consciousness. All of that's also a real hindrance to deep practice, really gets in the way, blocks us from relating well to life. But we can relate well to those energy shifts. But first, just to mention, there's also this fifth hindrance, which is doubt. Doubt and confusion. And we can really get frozen by this. You know, we can really lose faith in what we're doing, lose faith in ourselves, lose faith in the teachings, lose faith in the practice, lose faith in retreat. So we really can be unclear about what we should be doing. And yet we can also fall into patterns of practice where we are quite clear about what we're doing. So one of the things I like about the don't scratch the itch meditation, which we did at the beginning, is we know what we're doing. We're just waiting for an itch to come. Right? You could have doubt that, is this got any meaning, has this got any point, you know. But we know what we're doing, and we know what we're looking for, and then we know what we're going to do when we get there. We're not going to scratch it. We're just going to be with an itch, maybe for the first time ever. We'll see an itch appear, stay for a while, and disappear without having been scratched. Remarkable. So at any time we can know what it is that we're going to do. The two sorts of thinking practice gives us something to do with a mind that keeps on thinking. We can have a sense, I can't meditate because I'm thinking too much. Well, you can meet your thinking as a meditation. So there's no escape, I'm sorry, you don't get a break. You have to meditate all of the time with all of your experiences. There's nothing outside the range. And in a moment I want to talk about ways that we can meet different forms, how our energy appears to us. so that we can also bring that into the meditation. You know, restlessness can be such a useful mode for meditation. And sleepiness can be so interesting for us to really explore and find the fruits in that experience. And all of this can ease the doubt, right? Because the doubt can really stop us from progressing because we feel like it's sucked all the juice out of us. Oh, there's nothing to do and there's no point in doing anything. And then if we don't do anything, you know, then nothing changes and then it just stays more stuck. So we have to do something, we have to move something, we have to try something and see what happens. Now what happens if when I'm really tired I stand up? I don't want to stand up. Yeah, but what would happen if you did stand up? You know, and we do it, and we explore. It's like, actually, things are changing. Of course they're changing. You've changed something really significant. You were sitting down and falling asleep, now you're standing up and falling asleep. It's not the same experience. You can be really afraid of falling over. That's keeping you a little bit more awake as well. You know, and all of these things, there's always something to do. And the way of relating to it really matters. So energy, yeah. Energy's good, but of course we can have too much of it and we can have too little of it. So too little energy in the system, what helps with that? So some of us must have been kind of exploring this and perhaps we already know a few techniques that we can use that work. But if we're with the breath, for example, it can be possible to feel the breath more intensely. We can work with the breath in ways. One way that we can do actually is we can imagine a brightness in the breath. Now, some of you might be thinking, but that's not real. That's not real mindfulness if you're imagining things on top of the direct experience. And I'm not in the mood for arguing against that. So if you don't want to do it, then that's fine. But it can be really useful to imagine a lot of light in the breath. Yeah. It can be really supportive, actually, to feel the breath as an upward energy. Yeah. Often we kind of imagine, feel, sense, know the breath as an inward and downward kind of energy. What happens if we imagine the breath actually kind of filling up from down here upwards and up through, filling up the head? And we could even breathe out of the top of the head. Okay, so if you didn't want to do the light, I probably shouldn't have gone there with that one. But what we can find is different ways to bring interest, curiosity. Can I breathe like that? Is that okay? Is that allowed? Is that still a meditation if I'm breathing in ways which are, you know, biologically impossible? It turns out it is. It's allowed, yeah? We're just being present with the breath, present with the rhythm of the breath, but we're doing it in ways which are pleasing to us, enjoyable to us, and interesting. And all of those are usually qualities that bring energy. Yeah? So you see, there's ways to work with a lack of energy. Now, it could be possible that we have a lack of energy because we're really, really tired. Yeah, we're actually, we're exhausted. So the pace of life these days is too fast. Yeah, we work too hard, and we don't sleep well enough. So part of what we're doing on retreat can be that we actually make sure we catch up on sleep. You know, so have that siesta after lunch. Try and sleep well in the night. If you're really, really tired and you're almost falling asleep before coming in for the meditation, maybe go back to your bed and have a nap. Yeah, like that might be a better use of your time. Then come back in the hall when you've got a bit more energy, got a bit more juice, and you can do the practice well. If we tend to mostly fall asleep when we're in the meditation hall, then something else is going on. Yeah? Could be that there could be some aversion to experience that's coming through in the escape of sleep. It could be that we're making ourselves actually too comfortable. It's too similar to sleep for us. And you know, this is the bit of the talk that people really love. So make yourself less comfortable and you won't fall asleep as much. Yeah. So standing up in the meditation hall is a really wonderful posture. There's a little bit of description on the board there for how to do this posture. I mean, it can just be really, really helpful as a way of generating energy in the system. We can also adjust the breath, breathing in more deeply and actually holding the breath within. What that does, energizing the cells in that way. Also, what I like to do is breathing out really fully and not breathing in. Feeling that kind of tension in the system of not getting its next breath. That kind of brightens something in the system. You can only do this temporarily. Yeah? Don't want anyone passing out. So really being appropriate as well, that sometimes our energy might come at unusual times. Right? We might wake up in the night with suddenly a lot of energy, and then we might then be struggling to go to sleep as much as we were struggling to stay awake in the meditation hall. So we have these kind of mixed life going on. You know, in the day I'm struggling to meditate and stay awake, and in the night I'm struggling to sleep. And what to do? So start meditating in the night. You know, you can either sit up in your bed or you can come here. You know, we don't lock the door here. You can come in and enjoy your place in the hall. And after a while you'll probably start falling asleep, yeah. So then you head back over there and then get back into that rhythm. Or whatever it is. So oftentimes what we need to do is bring a bit more focus into the meditation, yeah. That brings the interest, brings the experimentation, something I want to try. So hopefully some of that will feel available. So the next, I just want to touch a little bit on when we have too much energy. I don't know if people have been experiencing this much, but you know, there can be a really profound busyness in the mind, you know, agitation of thoughts, worry, restlessness in the body, and you know, too much energy. And it can be very, very hard to be with. One thing that's always interesting about these hard-to-be-with experiences is that they're actually perfectly revealed in awareness in this moment. Yeah. Awareness actually isn't in the slightest bit disturbed by all the energy in the system, all the busyness of the mind. It's revealing it perfectly to us, which is terribly annoying, but it's perfectly revealing this experience. So this is a moment in consciousness. And what happens when we just rest with that? Whoa, this is what's happening in consciousness. And for something to happen in consciousness, there has to be enough space for it. So there is already enough space for this, but that feels like the limit. But actually consciousness can be bigger than that. Yeah. There has to be a space that's holding this space. If you're aware of space, what are you aware of that space within? Must be something slightly larger. It can also be helpful to tune into sounds that opens that space for us. It can also be helpful to really root ourselves in the breath. Right? Just hold ourselves steady here. Let ourselves have our space to be present. And that whole quality of allowing, releasing. This experience is happening, yeah. So let's not fight against it. That resistance to it is really one of the core factors that's making this so difficult. When we release that a little bit, tuning into the consciousness of this experience, it will also be really supportive. Now, of course, some of these thoughts and concerns that we can have are really to do with things in our life that need attention. It could be to do with actions that we've done that we regret. It could be things that have been done to us that are hurting us, that are causing pain. So it's really, really good that we are skillful and kind and wise and appropriate with our practice, with lots of metta, with the support in this case, you've only really got me and Zara, so support of the teachers or those that we can turn to and explore these experiences and open them out so that they don't cause us as much distress, hopefully. So the antidote to this, in many ways, is opening the space of awareness. Because the context can be so helpful. We can really get laser focused, really get contracted around this energetic, too much energy system. And that contraction is squeezing it and causing a lot more agitation. And tends that as we open the space, even if there's a lot of energy, that energy can come through. And actually a lot of energy can be okay in meditation. Yeah, it can actually be what feels like too much energy, but by opening the space, it can come through us, and come through. Sometimes meditation unlocks a lot of energy. You know, suddenly it's like, whoa, really intense, like fireworks going off inside. It's good then, you know, we allow that to happen by increasing the space. So we've covered a lot here, you know, with the greed, the aversion, particularly through the ways of thinking, but it could appear in other ways perhaps. We have the too much energy, the too little energy, and the doubt of not quite knowing what to do. Yeah, those are the key hindrances that are spoken about, and they can be really well supported through our practice to meet these experiences well. But I just wanted to name something about the doubt, which I think might also be helpful to say. It's actually good to have a healthy amount of doubt about these teachings and practices, and teachers, and even ourselves. Yeah? A healthy amount of doubt. And it's up to each of us to decide just how much that is. Yeah? Because like salt in our food, we can bring out the flavor a little bit, bring out the interest, bring out the investigation in the meditation. But if we have a load of salt in the food, it just tastes of salt. So too much doubt is quite damaging to us. It's quite harmful to us. But why shouldn't we have questions about these practices? But let's be careful that we're not presuming that they're fake or false or wrong by default, that we're actually interested to explore. What do they do? And what is this good for? Why would anyone do a don't scratch the itch meditation? And what's it actually supportive of? What's it good for? Where doesn't it reach? And that healthy doubt is the investigation and discernment that can be so, so useful. You know, the Buddha would say many times, you know, don't just do this and don't believe that it's going to work just because I said so. See for yourself. Come and see. You know, let's really have that spirit. And for the end, maybe the opposite of doubt isn't certainty. Yeah? Like certainty can also be too rigid. Closes off. It's not investigating. And so that healthy doubt hopefully is in support of clarity. Yeah, maybe clarity is the opposite of doubt. Clarity and faith. And the willingness to show up and explore our experience. So I think I'll leave it there. We'll just have a few quiet moments to practice together.